From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Frischberg and Bob Dureau are jazz pianists and songwriters who are also distinctive singers. They've collaborated on a new CD. On today's Fresh Air, we'll listen to their recording, and from the archive, we'll feature concerts and interviews with them. Also, an interview with actor Kevin Spacey. He won an Academy Award for his role in American Beauty. He stars in the new film, Pay It Forward. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak said he is reassessing the peace process with the Palestinians. The announcement follows another day of clashes in which at least 9 Palestinians were killed. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
It was supposed to be the day that a truce agreed earlier this week in Egypt took hold. Instead, each side accused the other of violating it. Near Nablus, Palestinian gunmen fired on Israeli soldiers from an olive grove. Palestinians also converged on Israeli army posts across the West Bank and Gaza. And gunmen in a Palestinian village fired on a Jewish neighborhood in southern Jerusalem, captured by Israel in 1967. Israel fired back with tank-mounted machine guns. The army also fired from combat helicopters into a village near Bethlehem. Prime Minister Barak said he will decide after this weekend's Arab summit whether to call a timeout in the peace process. He also repeated his invitation to the opposition Likud party to form an emergency unity government. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has told President Clinton he is committed to a deal to end violence between Israelis and Palestinians despite today's violence. The White House says the two spoke by telephone for about 15 minutes today. Thousands of mourners attended a funeral today for Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan. He was killed in a plane crash Monday night while campaigning for the U.S. Senate. His oldest son and an aide also died in the crash. A French court has broken new ground in international law by ruling that Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi can be prosecuted in France for the 1989 bombing of a civilian airliner. French government prosecutors are expected to appeal the decision. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
The events were similar to the Lockerbie bombing over Scotland. A jet with 170 passengers aboard blew up over the desert in Niger. France immediately suspected Libya, and 6 Libyan citizens have been convicted in absentia. But the main French anti-terrorism magistrate wanted to investigate Gaddafi himself for complicity. State prosecutors argued this is impossible because Gaddafi benefits from what's known as sovereign immunity, protection from prosecution for a head of state. This immunity has been waived for heads of state charged with crimes against humanity or systematic torture, for example. But international lawyers say today's Gaddafi ruling, if upheld, would be new because his alleged crime, while heinous, falls well short of those categories. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials closed up 83 points at 10,226. The Nasdaq also up 64 points to 3,482. And the S&P 500 gained 8 points to close at 1,397. Trading was active. This is NPR. A former Army sergeant has admitted helping alleged terrorist Osama bin Laden to bomb 2 U.S. embassies in 1998. Ali Mohammed is one of 17 people indicted in the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, which killed 224 people, including 12 Americans. Vice President Al Gore says he will welcome help from President Clinton in the final weeks before the election, but he told the Associated Press he is running his own campaign. Gore attended the funeral for Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan today before flying to New Orleans. Meanwhile, Republican presidential hopeful George W. Bush campaigned in New Hampshire and Maine today. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Hav Harris reports.
Bush said it was good to be back in New Hampshire, a state which he said taught him humility by voting overwhelmingly for his former rival John McCain in the presidential primary. McCain was supposed to join Bush today but declined due to food poisoning. Bush told supporters at St. Anselm College in Goffstown, New Hampshire, that the same independent voters that voted for McCain need to understand the distinctions between himself and Democrat Al Gore.
I want the people of this state to hear loud and clear there's a philosophical divide. This is a man who trusts Washington, D.C. And as you'll hear in the policies that I want to talk about, I trust the people.
Opinion surveys show the presidential race in New Hampshire as close as it is nationally, and its four electoral votes could swing the election either way. For NPR News, I'm Av Harris in Concord, New Hampshire.
The head of Argentina's spy agency has resigned after criticizing the governing coalition. State Intelligence Department Chief Fernando de Santibanez had also been named in a bribery scandal. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and Amgen, advancing the frontiers of medicine and improving the lives of patients through biotechnology.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from Saab, introducing its new 2001 lineup with the OnStar communication system. Information available at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dave Frischberg and Bob DeRoe have a new CD on which they perform together and separately. They're both jazz pianists and singer-songwriters. They co-wrote the hipster wannabe anthem, I'm Hip. We'll hear from DeRoe later on this archive edition. First, we have a concert and interview with Frischberg, recorded in 1995. His songs have the wit that's associated with American popular song of the past, but most of his lyrics are about the anxieties and absurdities of life today, like this song, Lookin' Good, featured on his new CD.
Long as you're looking good, you can win the admiration of the common population. You can be a star long as you're looking good. You have made the main connection. You can take the next election. Don't care who you are. Don't have to know a thing. Just look like you're a sensation. Don't have to dance or sing to get that standing ovation. Long as you're looking good, let that be your main credential. You'll get treatment preferential. It's a rule that's still essentially ironclad. Remember, you can't look bad long as you're looking good. Looking good, you can tell the world to shove it, show them crap and make them love it. You can run their life long as you're looking good. They'll believe you walk on water, even trust you with their daughter, sometimes with their wife. Just leave them mesmerized, give their eyes a picture to play with. You'd be so surprised how much you can get away with, long as you're looking good. You can show up late for dinner, play the saint or play the sinner, a blank, a crank, a rank beginner, or just a cad. Remember, you can't look bad long as you're looking, long as you're looking good.
Dave Frischberg from the new CD, Who's On First. Frischberg's best-known songs include My Attorney Bernie, Heart's Desire, Sweet Kentucky Ham, Quality Time, and Peel Me a Grape. Some of the performers who have recorded his songs are Rosemary Clooney, Mel Torme, Diana Krall, Susanna McCorkle, Blossom Deary, and Jackie and Roy. Before our interview, I paged through a book of Frischberg's sheet music. It's not like I could sit down and play the arrangements or anything, but I was looking through the book of sheet music, and in one of the songs it says, where it should say, you know, like, andante or moderate tempo or something, it says conversationally. I thought that's perfect. Yes, that song should... It's not the kind of notation you usually see in sheet music, but I thought, yes, that's exactly right.
Well, it's not that uncommon, actually.
Really?
I think I've seen a lot of songs that have... those kind of expressions, you know, forgetting the old Italian or German expressions. Conversationally makes a lot of sense. You know, I like to, a lot of my songs sound so much better if they're sung conversationally. Like, I hear singers sing ballads of mine, and they hold those notes out because I know singers. They like to hear the sound of their voice, and they get caught up in how it feels and how good it feels to produce those tones. I think a lot of times it works against the song. Holding notes out for a long time, you know. Sometimes I wish I want to tell them when I say conversationally, I mean, you know, you got to throw that away. That's an aside almost. I'm not complaining, but a lot of times when I hear singers do my songs, I wish they wouldn't sing so much. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Well, the last time I saw you perform, it was in New York a couple of years ago, and you did a song called
Wallflower Lonely.
Yeah, Wallflower Lonely,
Cornflower Blue. Yeah.
And it was I really liked the song a lot, and there was a very actually funny story that went along with the song, and I'd love for you to tell the story and play the song.
Well, when I was first starting to write songs in New York, and I'm talking about I had moved to New York, and this was the early 60s, in those days, it was customary for a songwriter to bring the songs directly to the publisher's office, and then you sit at the piano and you sing the song and perform it for the publisher. And the publisher, if he likes it, then he has demo records made and so forth. That was the norm. I'll shorten this up, but anyway, what happened was a guy asked me to write a cowboy song, the way he called it. Play a cowboy song. Why don't you write a cowboy song? So I came back and I wrote him. I said, like, I think I got a cowboy song. So this was it. This is what I wrote, you know. I'm wallflower lonely, cornflower blue. You'll never know how sad I feel remembering you. I tried to forget you. What good does it do? I'm wallflower lonely, cornflower blue. When we were together, it was sunflower weather. Today only clouds are in view. Your love made me happy more than I knew. But now I'm only wallflower lonely, cornflower blue. So that was my little entry into the country songwriting business, you know. So the guy says to me, the publisher says to me, he listens to that song, he says, you mind if I just give you a little tip on how to construct a song? I said, no, you know, please help me out. He says, play the bridge for me. I said, okay. When we were together, it was sunflower. He says, stop. What's that chord on the word sunflower? I said, well, it's a B seventh. He said, that's where you lose them. So what are you talking about? He says, well, that's not a cowboy chord.
What, did you have a witty retort?
No, later on I thought of a witty retort, and then when I tell the story, I pretend like I really said it at the time, but I didn't think of it till years later. I should have said to him, you mean if I play a B7th, I'll lose the audience? And he would say, yes, and then I would say, I didn't know it was that easy. But I didn't think of it at the time. As a matter of fact, I probably, in those days, I probably took him seriously and probably avoided B7th for a few weeks.
See, now that's the kind of song you probably would not have written had you not been given this, like, unusual assignment, right?
Exactly. But, you know, in those days, I was trying to write to satisfy the publishers and those people who were in the music business, the people who populated the industry. I was trying to satisfy them. So if they wanted cowboy songs, if I'm going to be a songwriter, I got to write what the market wants. So I tried to write the cowboy song, and I tried to write theatrical songs. I got involved with Frank Lesser's publishing company, and they asked me to write songs for certain properties they had in mind. It was almost a little exercise they were giving me to see how I would deal with a theatrical situation, you know?
Oh, what'd you write?
Gosh, I wrote a few songs for them. One of them I kept in my act for years after that. It was a song called Another Song About Paris. That song, Another Song About Paris, oh... Lovers in the rain and flowers in the stall on the Rue Madeleine near the Place Pigalle. How amusing when the gypsies stole our wine. Remember Notre Dame where we chatted with the hunchback? The dim cafe where we had to send the lunch back? Ah, Paris in the spring. It was all too, too divine. Another song about Paris. Is there room for one more? Is there really a note or a word we all haven't heard before? And so on, about how many songs there are about Paris and how rife with cliches there are, you know.
Well, that's on
that was
your...
a song I wrote for as an exercise almost for the lesser people that they wanted to see what I'd come up with, you know.
So what kind of feedback did they give you?
Well, they were real
what
nice.
What grade did they give you?
I'll tell you what happened. You know, I worshipped Frank Lesser. Especially when I first began to write songs, he specifically was my model. I thought he was the best songwriter going. I still do think he was the best songwriter of his generation. Anyway, he called me into his office, you know. He called me on the phone or had someone call, and I had an appointment to meet him himself, and I hadn't ever met Lesser. And I sat in his office for maybe an hour or more while he discussed my songs that I had submitted to the company, and he told me how much he liked them, and he told me what I could do to improve. He wanted to talk about lyrics mostly and not about music. He said he wasn't equipped to talk about music. I said, what are you kidding? The most happy fellow. He didn't want to talk about it, you know. He said, no, let's talk about lyrics. And he told me such interesting things, insights into how he makes his decisions about lyrics. He said to me in one song, he said, look at this song. Look at this colorful word you put here. It's a very colorful word, and it operates beautifully in the lyric. He says, but don't squander it there. He said, put it someplace where there's a rest so that the audience can listen to that and savor it and understand it. He says, if you throw it away in the context of that jumble of notes, he said, they'll lose it. Either that, or when they hear it, their minds will be distracted and they'll miss the next few lines.
What else did he tell you?
Some kind of anatomical reference that he didn't like. He said, don't, for God's sake, he said, don't say things like my heart is breaking in two. He says, don't talk about the heart as if it were an organ, because then the listener sees this image of a heart, a picture of a heart breaking in two. That's not what you want to see at all. Because he was very concerned with leading the listener through the lyric and not interrupting the listener. He was very concerned with what the listener was perceiving with those lyrics.
My guest is Dave Frischberg, a composer, pianist, singer. Many of his songs, like Heart's Desire, Sweet Kentucky Ham, have been recorded by other performers, including Rosemary Clooney. And he has a whole bunch of CDs that are around. There's another way you might know Dave Frischberg without realizing that this is him. And that is through, what's the kids' music show is called where they teach you how to add?
Schoolhouse Rock.
Schoolhouse Rock, yeah. Mm. And one of your songs from there is actually quite famous.
Isn't that amazing?
I'm Just a Bill.
I'm Just a Bill.
About how a bill becomes a law.
Yeah.
And this was even in the film Reality Bites.
That's right.
That's how well known it is.
Well,
among the generation that grew up with these shows. And some of it's still on ABC, I guess, Saturday morning.
I'm Just a Bill is still on. It's still on rotation. I wrote that in 1974, maybe. That's 20-some years ago, and it's still on. And a lot of people know this song, and it shocks me because I never paid much attention to it. I don't watch kids' television.
We have to play it.
I will. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while you're waiting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill. That was sung by Jack Sheldon in the original recording of that. Listen to this, Terry. A couple of years ago in Portland, a friend of mine was in the hospital. I went to visit him, and I went to his room, and there was like he was sharing a room with somebody else who must have been really sick because there was this big screen. I peeked behind the screen, and this other patient was ghastly pale, and he had all kinds of tubes stuck in every orifice. It looked like he was on his way out. So I was talking to my friend, and my friend says, "Well, what have you been doing?" I said, "Well, I'm working for Schoolhouse Rock again." He says, He says, "Gee, that thing you wrote years ago, I'm Just a Bill, I still hear that." And from behind the screen came the voice of this other patient, and he said, "Did you write I'm Just a Bill?" And I said, "Yeah," I said to thin air, you know. And then from behind the screen, he began to sing it, the dying man singing my song, "I'm Just a Bill." Yes, oh, God, it was more than I can handle.
Oh, how odd. What a strange experience.
Very odd. You know, you never know when. I kept saying, "You're singing too much. Just do it conversationally."
Dave Frischberg recorded in 1995. He has a new CD called Who's On First. It also features Bob Dureau, who we'll hear from later in the program. This is Fresh Air. Before I got into radio, I had a job in which I sat alone in a small cinder block office all day typing. The way I survived that job was listening to WBFO, a public radio station in Buffalo, New York. It filled my day with interesting interviews as well as jazz and blues recordings. I guess that's one of the things I value about listening to public radio. It gives me a way to connect to things I care about, even if I'm alone in a windowless room or driving on the highway. There's a price to pay for having public radio to turn to, but it's only the price of a pledge. Please call with your support. Thank you. Let's get back to our 1995 concert and interview with Dave Frischberg. His new CD, Who's On First, also features Bob Dureau. Now, when you started to play piano, what did you play?
Boogie Woogie, the blues. I was a blues player. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I was deep into Pete Johnson. He was my hero, Pete Johnson from Kansas City, and Joe Turner. My brother Mort, the guy with the keychain, he used to sing like Joe Turner.
Really?
Yeah, and so he and I would play the Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, Boogie Woogie records, and we would copy them. I would copy them off the record, and we would. That's how I began playing the blues. I could play in C, F, and G, the blues.
Well, I'd love to hear you play something solo at the piano. I mean, to play a piano solo.
Okay.
Well, tell us what you want to play and why. Why you've chosen it.
I haven't chosen it. Let me think.
Okay. And while you're thinking, I'll say I really love your piano playing. So when you perform on the show, I always like to get you to play something.
Well, you know, I mentioned Jay McShann. I love that Jay McShann band from Kansas City. I can play a couple of things that I remember from the Jay McShann band, which contained Charlie Parker, by the way, that band did. So Jumpin' Blues, you know. And thank you. Walter Brown sang with Jay McShann. Confessing the Blues. That was the stuff that I used to try to play like. I loved McShann's playing, and I loved Count Basie's playing, and Pete Johnson's playing. I was hooked on the Kansas City jazz musicians.
Did you ever get to see these guys play when you were young?
Well, I had occasion to meet and play with Jay McShann and duets and stuff. That was really fun. I admired him so. And I did meet Count Basie under very odd circumstances once. I don't know if you want me to go into it. It was very strange. I was rehearsing the show for Mel Torme, who was going to arrive a few hours hence. And I was rehearsing the band. And when I got there to rehearse the band for Mel Torme, this was a very odd circumstance because I had nothing to do with Mel Torme at the time. It was one of those phone calls. And when I got there, the band was Count Basie's band. And I was rehearsing them. And Basie stepped aside, and I went to the piano and began to rehearse Count Basie's band and Mel Torme's opening number. I felt completely at a loss, and because I hadn't heard the music either. So I said, well, this first one is called, God, what was it called, Doggin' Around or something like that. It was a Basie piece, you know. So I said, is everybody ready? And Freddie Green was sitting there, and I said, Freddie, you don't have your music out. And he looked at me with this cold look, and he says, I wrote this. I rehearsed the band, and I said, well, that's fine. And Basie, from where he was sitting, said, what do you mean that's fine? That's terrible. Let me show you how it's supposed to sound. Oh, those guys took me that day. It was funny, actually.
Dave Frischberg recorded in 1995. His new CD with Bob Dureau is called Who's On First. We'll hear from Dureau in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, jazz pianist, songwriter, and singer Bob Dureau. He was also the music director of Schoolhouse Rock. He has a new CD with Dave Frischberg. Also from the archive, Kevin Spacey. He's starring in the new film, Pay It Forward. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colwood Way, a memoir, the new novel from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few years after I started listening to jazz pianist, singer, and songwriter Bob Dureau, I felt kind of sorry about a turn his career had taken. He had become the music director of an educational animated series called Schoolhouse Rock. Little did I know how clever and catchy some of the songs would be, and that he'd become better known for these songs than he'd been for his previous records. Dureau's new CD features him performing with Dave Frischberg, who we heard from earlier. Let's hear their duet on the title track, Who's On First.
Well, Bob, they finally booked the two of us in tandem. We can't come on and just sing songs at random. How will we handle this project to which we have lent ourselves?
Yeah, we've agreed to put ourselves on exhibition. It's the two of us from now till intermission. We ought to come up with a logical way to present ourselves.
We got a problem.
Partly protocol,
partly procedure,
partly pride.
Which of us is the frim-fram sauce?
And which is the shafafa on the side?
In other words, who's on first? We got a show to do here. Who's opening for who here? How do we run this date?
Who's on first? Are you the mesmerizer? Am I the appetizer? We better negotiate. Say I come up and get roaring and really tear up the place. Then you come on and get boring.
Well, that's known as a change of pace.
Anyhow, who's on first? It's really an urgent matter. Who's the former and who's the latter? We better get this straight. It's not a suggestion of who is the best or worst. It's simply a question of who's on first.
Bob Dureau and Dave Frischberg from their new CD, Who's On First. They co-wrote the hipster wannabe anthem, I'm Hip. I spoke with Bob Dureau in 1996. He told me that the idea for Schoolhouse Rock came from an advertising agency.
I went up to meet the president of the agency, and it was his idea, and his name was David B. McCall of McCaffrey and McCall. He said, my little boy can, you know, sing along with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, but he can't memorize his multiplication tables. So I had the idea, why not put the multiplication tables to rock music and call it Multiplication Rock? What do you think? And I said, well, yeah, that's pretty interesting. And he said, well, but don't write down to the kids. Well, I learned later that he had invited other Broadway songwriters to do this task, and they came up with a more simple doggerel type of songwriting, writing down, as it were, to children.
So when he said, so what do you think, what did you really think?
I thought, well, yeah, this this could be, you know, a limited idea. But when he added, don't write down to children, the hackles on my neck arose, and I got quite intrigued. And so I agreed to tackle it, and I spent about 3 weeks before I would let myself write the first song. I thought first, looked in math books, and since I picked my first title, it was called Three is a Magic Number, I even looked in magic and occult books for the reasons that three might be a magic number.
Did you get anything from those books that you used
indeed
in the song? What'd you get?
Mm-hmm. Well, that it was one of the magic numbers, and that it was... you know, embodied in certain things like the Trinity, the old sayings, the heart and the brain and the body, faith, hope, and charity, trinities of sorts. So I got mainly that, trinities. And, of course, I also was an admirer of Buckminster Fuller, so I was thinking of his triangle concept that makes construction so strong. Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number. It takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand. It takes three wheels to make a vehicle called a tricycle. Every triangle has three corners. Every triangle has three sides. No more, no less. You don't have to guess. When it's three, you can see it's a magic number.
Now, do you think most of the people who grew up listening to your songs and most of the people in the bands now performing your songs on the new CD, do you think that they have any idea that these weren't written and performed by people in advertising agencies or theme houses, that they were written by you, an interesting and eccentric jazz performer, and that the other songs, some of the other songs on here, are sung by interesting and eccentric jazz performers?
Yes, well, I'm sure they didn't even think about such things. They grew up and they learned and they watched. They were a captive audience, one of my partners pointed out, George Newell, because, you know, they were watching Saturday morning cartoons and suddenly there would be this little 3-minute film and they got hooked on them and it actually did them some good. And as we went on in our productions, I kept bringing in some of my buddies from the jazz world. So it was a kind of a a little bit of a underground movement there.
Yeah, well, you brought in Dave Frischberg, the singer and songwriter and pianist, trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon, singer Blossom Deary.
Yes, Grady Tate,
mm-hmm.
A drummer who sings, or a singer who drums. Excuse me, Grady, I didn't mean that.
Now, I'd like to give our listeners who've been hearing your Schoolhouse Rock songs a taste of the other side of Bob Dureau. So I thought I'd actually play something that you recorded in concert on our show once that you've also recorded on your own records. And it's a song called I'm Hip, which you co-wrote with Dave Frischberg. You did the music, he did the lyric.
And, that's right.
And he also worked on some of the Schoolhouse Rocks. He did I'm Just a Bill. And so you recorded this on Fresh Air in 1982. This is Bob Dureau, piano and vocals, I'm Hip.
Well, I'm a hip, I'm alive. I enjoy any joint where there's jive. I'm on top of every trend. Look at me go, vodeo-do. Bobby Dylan, he knows my friend. We're so hip, hanging out in Malibu. Well, I'm hip, but not weird. Like you notice, I don't wear a beard. Beards wear in, but now they're out. They had their day, now they're passé. Just ask me if you in doubt, cause I'm a hip. Now I'm deep, deep into Zen. Meditation and macrobiotics. And just as soon as I can, I intend to get into narcotics. I gotta try some of that stuff. Cause I'm cool, cool as a cuke. I'm a cart, I'm a cat, I'm a kook. I get so much out of life. Really, I do Scooby-Doo-Boo. One more time, play Mac the Knife. Let her rip. I may flip, but I'm hip.
This was just a fantastic recording, and I'm really proud that you did it on our show. So,
oh, thanks.
In a self-serving way, I'll just get that.
I've gotten many reports from NPR fans saying, oh, we heard you doing I'm Hip on Fresh Air.
Oh, good.
That's
good.
Great. It's lasting.
Good.
Well, that's me. That's the other me. That's what I do. I go into smoky nightclubs and play the piano and sing.
Bob Dureau, recorded in 1996. He has a new CD with Dave Frischberg called Who's On First. Coming up, an interview with Kevin Spacey. This is Fresh Air. Kevin Spacey stars in the new film Pay It Forward. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Spacey recorded in 1991 before he became a movie star. His films include The Usual Suspects, L.A. Confidential, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, The Negotiator, and American Beauty, for which he won an Academy Award. I'm one of the Spacey fans who discovered him in the TV series Wise Guy. He played bad guy Mel Profit, a twisted drug dealer and corrupt businessman with a thing for his sister. Here he is pulling a gun on the hero of the series, undercover agent Vinny Terranova.
Do you like roulette? One round, six chambers.
Come on, Mr. Profit, I think maybe you got a nose full. Don't do this.
Not cocaine. Rule one, don't inhale the retail. What I take is medicine, Jack. Prescribed PX formulas. Dr. Feelgood's number nine. It doesn't put me to sleep, but it makes me feel a whole lot better.
Round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows.
You've done theater and movies, but really I think you're like your breakthrough role in terms of public recognition was on Wise Guy, in the role of Mel Profit. Did you expect that would happen on TV?
One of the reasons that Wise Guy intrigued me, both as a character and then in terms of how we approached it, was I felt that I'd watched so many actors play bad guys as sort of slick and antiseptic and kind of cool and in control, that because Mel was so bizarre as a character, that when you're playing a character like that, the parameters are much wider. You can get away with a lot more. I felt that if we could approach it almost with total abandon, which isn't done all that much on television, certainly in series television.
You've said that you wanted to meet with Cannell before taking the role, and you wanted to tell him that you wanted to slowly build the character, and that it might not be clear right from the start what you were doing.
Well, yeah, Stephen didn't understand. I turned down the show at first, and Stephen didn't understand, you know, who this young pup, virtually unknown New York stage actor, was turning down a major role on a primetime series. He just couldn't figure me. So he thought, well, and Steve is a very smart and intuitive man, and he said, well, will he come in and talk to me? And I said, sure. So I went in that night. This all, by the way, happened in about 12 hours. I went in that night after I'd met him in the afternoon originally, and we sat and we talked for an hour. And I'd had a couple of experiences doing episodics as a guest, and they weren't very good experiences. And while I thought that I might be able to do something, I was afraid that the same kind of conditions would be at play on this show.
What kind of conditions?
Well, a lot of times if you're a guest on a TV series, you find that, in particular if you're not known, if you're starting out, you find that there's a lot of line producers who sort of stand behind the camera asking a lot of questions about, why is his hair like that? Or why is he wearing that tie? What's he doing with his face? Why doesn't he just play it the way God? And it becomes very confining as an actor to have someone there who is not necessarily artistically inclined making decisions and judgments. And on Wise Guy, because I felt that the character, I thought, this isn't going to be something that I walk on the set on the first day and decide how to play. This is something that I want to have evolve and grow over these seven episodes, and it ended up being nine in the end. But I thought I said to Stephen in this meeting, I said, if you let me do what I think I can do with this role, you're going to think that you have an actor who's completely lost his mind as you watch the dailies, which are what they watch every day of the film that you've shot, because it won't make sense to you, and it might not even make sense in totality, but I think we'll be able to do something that will be interesting and unique.
I'm interested in finding out a little bit about you. You were born in New Jersey, but you grew up in Los Angeles. Tell us something about your childhood. Why did your parents move? What did they do?
My father was a technical procedure writer, and he worked for corporations as diverse as Rockwell. And what that means is, very briefly, the guys who put together the F-16, they have to put it together with a manual. My father wrote that kind of manual, not the F-16 in particular, but as an example. And my mother was a private secretary. She worked at Busch Gardens out in California for a number of years.
Busch Gardens, oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you go there a lot?
Are you kidding? I had more Budweiser sweaters than I can count.
Oh boy. I've always figured, you know, you can't afford to go to Europe, but you can go to Busch Gardens.
That's right. That's right. And I started when I went to school out there. We moved around quite a lot. I think it's one of the reasons why I feel at home wherever I go, because we moved so much that I had to make wherever I went my new home. And I started a theater in junior high school. A guidance counselor suggested that I take a drama course, and I did, and they can't stop me yet.
Have you ever been very brash or aggressive about getting a part or getting an audition?
Extremely. I would not have done Long Day's Journey and Tonight with Mr. Lemon had I not taken no for an answer. When that play was being cast, the people who were casting it didn't feel I was right for it and wouldn't see me for about 8 months. So I finally went to a series of lectures that Dr. Jonathan Miller was giving stole my way into a party in his honor and got enough courage to sit in a chair next to him at one point and talked for about an hour and convinced him to see me for the part.
What were some of the things you told him when you got his attention that you think convinced him to give you an audition?
I think basically he understood what I'd been going through in terms of trying to get an audition. I think there are you know, sometimes people in this business, in this industry, who think that directors want big stars and big names for parts, and when in fact they're just really looking for the best actor for it. And so sometimes it's hard to get over those hurdles, and I think he just saw in my eyes and understood the struggle that I'd gone through in trying to get an audition and was sympathetic to it. And we had also talked for at least a good 40 minutes before I ever even brought up Long Day's Journey. I just got to know him a little bit and chatted, and I think out of that as well was what he decided to give me a shot.
Did you ever do stand-up comedy? I think I'd read that about you.
Yeah, you've done your work here. Yeah, I did, in California, actually. I did stand-up comedy for about a year and a half in clubs and bowling alleys. Wherever.
Bowling alleys?
Oh, unbelievable. And let me tell you, when you're doing your best material and there's not a peep, and then you hear the sound of bowling pins being knocked over, it's really so encouraging.
Well, I don't know if you'd really find your audience at a bowling alley.
Boy, I'll tell you. Well, at the time, I was doing an imitation of Johnny Carson in my act, and I realized that people who were at bowling alleys for midnight talent contests don't watch Johnny Carson, so they had no idea who I was doing. They were absolutely clueless.
What other stuff did you do?
I did a lot of topical material. I even actually, somewhere on tape, ABC did a pilot for a series called The Comedians, which was something that they'd done in Granada Television, done in England. And I hosted it as Johnny Carson. And somewhere there's a tape of this thing that we did in 1978. I was just out of high school. And occasionally, for benefits and things, I'll bring Carson out again because he's so much fun to do and he's difficult to do. I find a lot of comedians who I watch do him do a very sort of high profile Carson. It's very high comedy. They're impressionists who have to be identified. Their characters have to be identified in the first 10 seconds. And I approached Carson a little bit like an actor. I went sort of underneath and in fact. I did the Carson show, and it was a big thrill to do the show because I used to hang out at the Tonight Show and watch him live almost for an entire summer to learn how to do him. I didn't get a chance that night to do him because I ended up only having 3 minutes, but they promised the next time I'm on that Johnny and I will meet. and you know what? Nobody will care. It'll be a weird thing, but...
Oh, yeah. So why did you give up comedy and go into acting? Was that your plan all along?
It really wasn't a plan so much as it was just the way things turned out. A friend of mine had come to New York and attended Juilliard and had been encouraging me through letters to, if I was really serious about acting, I should come and audition. And I finally did and was accepted. And I think I just decided that I think I understand why actors, why people like Robin Williams and Steve Martin, Billy Crystal have gone out of stand-up comedy and ended up becoming actors. I think because stand-up comedy has so many limits to it that as a performer you just ultimately feel that you need to break out of it. I mean, I was never in their league by any measure, but I understand the idea of wanting to. And I was always an actor. Stand-up was sort of a sidelight, but it was ultimately an incredible experience and absolutely terrifying.
Kevin Spacey, recorded in 1991. He stars in the new movie Pay It Forward. This is Fresh Air. You may be asking yourself, well, why should I make a pledge if I'm not absolutely forced to? Here's one reason, and it directly affects your ability to continue listening to Fresh Air. Your station pays a subscription fee to broadcast the show, and that fee helps fund our production. The station relies on Fresh Air fans to pledge at least enough money to continue carrying the program. In other words, your pledge helps keep Fresh Air on the air in your community. So I hope you'll call. Thank you for your support. The new movie Pay It Forward stars Kevin Spacey, Helen Hunt, and Haley Joel Osment in his first role since The Sixth Sense. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Three quarters of the way into Pay It Forward, Kevin Spacey gives a speech. He does it in the character of Eugene Simonette, a demanding, caring Las Vegas middle school teacher whose face is a healed-over mask of scars from some long-ago third-degree burns. We have been waiting for this speech since we first met Eugene at the movie's start. Early on, one of Eugene's students, an 11-year-old named Travis, played by Haley Joel Osment, has asked about those scars, only to be rebuffed. Eugene becomes romantically involved with Travis's mom, Arlene, a recovering alcoholic, and still declines to talk about them. It's only when Arlene, played by Helen Hunt, starts seeing her abusive old husband again that Eugene is not only infuriated, but moved to speak. Then he doesn't just break his silence, he orchestrates a symphonic-like response. Here's an exchange that functions as a sort of prelude to the climactic revelations.
What do you want me to do?
Oh, I don't know. Be smart.
He's his father, Eugene.
He impregnated you, Arlene. In what other way is he been a father to Trevor? Unless knocking somebody around is a new family value.
What are you talking about? He never touched Trevor.
Oh, that's right. Only you. He only took it out on you. That's so much better.
What did Trevor tell you?
Enough. Darlene, secrets like that shouldn't be kept. What good does it do Trevor?
You weren't there. Ricky never meant to hit me. We were drunk. Oh.
What is it with women like you? Is that something you really tell yourself? Oh, it's okay he beat me? Trevor's okay? Trevor has locked himself in a bathroom, and he can't breathe, and he's hoping and praying that it will stop.
Trevor never went through that.
How do you know what Trevor went through?
Listening to Spacey, it's easy to understand why he's won two Oscars. His voice is a complex instrument, responsive to even the slightest modulations. What other actor can speak practically in a monotone for his less stressed exchanges and make it sound like musical conversation? When Spacey's characters do become angry or distressed or gleeful or scared, his gentle baritone allows for what sometimes seems like infinite gradations in volume. He can always go up one more register. You probably never think of Clint Eastwood while you're watching Spacey, but they are probably the only two leading men in Hollywood capable of expressing rage without raising their voices. So when Eugene finally tells us about the scars, it's the expected Spacey tour de force. No doubt theaters across the country will fall silent on schedule as rapt audiences listen to Eugene reveal the horror behind his face. But like almost everything else in Pay It Forward, it doesn't mean too much. The movie is a good example of what happens when melodrama degenerates into soap opera. Pay It Forward, which was written by Leslie Dixon from a novel by Katherine Ryan Hyde, falls into this trap almost immediately. The title gets its name from an assignment Eugene gives his class: find a way to improve the world and put it into action. Travis responds with a suggestion that everyone do a difficult and demanding favor for someone in trouble. Then, rather than be paid back, you tell the person to pay the favor forward by doing a good turn for three other people. This gimmick becomes the monster that ate the movie. in a subplot that begins 4 months after the main action, but dovetails with it by the film's climax, Jay Moore plays a cynical Los Angeles reporter who accidentally encounters what he dubs the pay-it-forward movement. More and more sob stories. In the meantime, the tentative, if euphonious, love match between Eugene and Arlene is subjected to the pressures of Travis's invention. It's not enough that they get together, but must do so under Travis's moral blanket. Director Mimi Later, fresh off Deep Impact, gets all this across with the understatement of, well, a comet hitting the Earth. This is, of course, so much hooey. People's problems aren't big because they become part of some national movement, and individuals aren't good because, or just because, they spark one. That's the whole point of melodrama, that each and every person can be, is, the star of an emotionally overscaled existence, that we all get to sing our arias, and we don't need cues, courtesy of Pay It Forward.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Tim Meadows. His new film, The Ladies' Man, is based on a character he created for Saturday Night Live. Also, a modern-day whale hunt, complete with tribal hunters, protesters, and media from around the world. We talk with author Robert Sullivan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us.